Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. This isn't just about money. This is about life. And now the host of the Power of the Purse podcast, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years, until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise. And it was something I could not only understand, but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't, until they were forced to, because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to an ongoing informative conversation about financial topics women should be more knowledgeable about. My mission is to help women reduce their financial illiteracy and develop a healthy relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Louise Nayer. Louise is the author of several books on a lot of different topics, and I can go through some of those, which I'd like to do right now, but the most important one that we're going to talk about today is Poised for Retirement, Moving from Anxiety to Zen. She also wrote a book that was called Burned, a Memoir, and that won the Wisconsin Library Association Award and was listed as one of the 10 upcoming titles in O Magazine. She co-authored How to Bury a Goldfish, 113 Rituals for Everyday Life. I can't wait to hear about that one. And she has written two books of poetry, Keeping Watch with funding from the NEA, and The Houses Are Covered in Sound. She received 6 California Arts Council grants to teach in senior centers and nursing homes and was a tenured English professor at City College of San Francisco for over 25 years. So leave it right there and say, welcome, Louise.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I can't wait to get into this because this is a topic that people rarely talk about when we talk about retirement. And as I've said before, and I'll say it again, too often retirement planning is just about the money. And nobody talks about what do you do with the 365 days a year when you don't have a job, and all of the psychological implications of not having a job and not having an identity apart from your job. And I know several people who have retired and then become very depressed. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is exactly the topic that you talk about, how to go from anxiety to Zen in retirement. So first I want to know, what prompted you to write this book on this subject?
Well, when I decided to leave City College, and I left a little bit earlier than might be considered prudent financially, but I knew I had to get out. Yeah, my neck was hurting from constant grading. I really wanted to write more and teach less, which had been a desire for many, many years of my life. And as I started to, there's a kind of a serpentine road that winds through City College. And as I walked on that road, I just started to think, well, what's it going to be like to be gone from this job? Because I met so many people that I would have, you know, 3 to 5 minute chats with. And I knew that that would be a huge loss when I left. As much as I wanted to get out and I wanted to write, I was lucky that I had something to do, but there are a million things that people can do and do to contribute to the world after they retire. I had that, but all these anxieties reared their heads. And for me, the go-to thing is writing. You know, it has soothed my soul for forever. And I thought, okay, I'm going to start a journal. And I kept a journal, and it was quite personal. of course. You know, it was little, you know, people I met and, you know, and what's it going to be like to not be in the classroom anymore? Because I actually loved being in the classroom. It was really the grading that was getting to me. And as I kept the journal, I thought, huh, you know, this could actually be a book and it could help other people. And then I started some of the things that you just mentioned, you know, losing your identity, losing your social life, you know, that system, those people that sometimes you spend more time with than you spend at home.
For sure.
You know, yeah, and what would that feel like? So that's how it started. It started as journal entries and then morphed into a book where I actually ended up interviewing people as well. So, you know, it became a bigger, more universal book, but it really started as a memoir and a way for me to deal with it, my anxiety. I thought, okay, because journaling is great, you know, for people about to retire or for retired people.
Yep. Or for anybody, for that matter.
Yeah, totally.
For anybody.
Totally. Yeah.
So when you started interviewing other people about this, did you find that they had a reluctance to want to share those very personal types of emotional reactions to retirement?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of times that people assume that other people don't really want to talk about certain things, but once they have the chance to talk about them, I just felt like people totally opened up in ways that I never imagined. And actually, in the book, I don't use people's last names. I just use their first names to protect their privacy. So I made that pretty clear in the beginning. So that was helpful. But yeah, there were a lot of universal things that people were going through, even though every story was unique.
What was the one that sticks out in your mind that was the most unexpected?
Huh. Well, I think, you know, what's interesting is I interviewed my husband because, you know, it was easy to do. I could just talk to him.
Guinea pig.
Yeah, exactly. Right there. And one thing is, you know, he's certainly a sensitive and very compassionate guy, but he's not somebody who would constantly be sharing his dreams. You know, I had this dream or I had that dream. And I'd say about 6 months before he retired, he just had lots of dreams that he wouldn't make it to the finish line, you know, that he would be running and he wouldn't get there. And for him, he wanted so badly to retire. He really had what he calls an empathy burnout in his job. He worked with seniors and developmentally disabled seniors. And he loved it for, you know, 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
And it was very, just getting hard. He said that he would sit there and think, now I have to make the coffee. Now I have to do this. He was talking himself through the whole day. And I did find that a lot of people I had strange dreams as well. I had one where an elevator opened and it looked like a warehouse elevator. And there were skeletons with long white hair and long nails. And they were beckoning me into the elevator. And I thought, if I go in there, I'm going to, I know, it was very creepy. I thought, if I go into that elevator, I'm going to be discarded. And that was another fear that people felt. Well, you know, I don't have my job identity. Who am I without my job? And, you know, I did. So I found that was really interesting. And that also the last 6 months before people retired was very, very difficult. You know, once they made the decision, you know, it was almost like, I'm out of here. I want to be gone. And then to sit there, whether you're trying to wait for, you know, better Social Security or better pension or more money in your 401k or, you know, all those different reasons that people stay maybe longer than their body and soul and heart, you know, I feel like for me getting out a little bit early preserved my health. And that was one thing that people talked about. You know, they just knew that. And of course, you know, health is mysterious. I mean, not, you know, some people aren't healthy and, you know, won't stay healthy. But I think listening to your body is really important. And I know Jim, my husband, did that. And I felt like I did that too. And so that was very helpful.
Well, was there a sense when you made the decision to retire that you were retiring from something but going to something else, or was it just from something and a blank slate in front of you?
You know, for me, and, you know, I've had people say things to me like, well, you were so lucky you had something you could go to. For me, I did know that I wanted to focus on my writing. And what I did, and this is something I would recommend to people, I joined a community before I retired. I joined what's called the San Francisco Writer's Grotto, and I knew I would have a place to go. I also knew that I think many people in 21st century America, I knew that I would have to bring in some money part-time with some teaching. So I had to go, you know, and that was part of my anxiety. You know, some people, you know, I'm not the poster child for financial, you know, perfection by any means. But I, on the other hand, I was hoping, and it did work out, that I could teach some workshops or do some things. But, you know, there are a lot of people who, when they retire, take, if you can afford it, take 6 months or a year off and do some traveling. And it doesn't even have to, you know, can be anywhere from a cruise to, you know, going to a national park. Yeah, or day trips. Or just sitting in a local cafe and reading, you know, and having that time.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, because when I think of the people that I have as clients who I've been with them years prior to retirement, at retirement, and post-retirement, there's a blur between that line of demarcation, you know, as I just expressed it. So to them, it's really more a case of transitioning out of one thing and into something else, and giving yourself some time to do a lot of what you just mentioned, put into the calendar the expectation that when you say, I'm done with this part of my life for the moment, I'm going to go do some traveling and do those things that I said I never had time to do.
Exactly.
And then that kind of gets boring after a while, because after you've done it, then you say, now what?
So there was
a need to make sure that there was that next step, so that it was meaningful and it had some value to it. And even if it was simply, as you said, going to a place where you joined a community. A lot of people can do this virtually, community,
and
they get involved. But I think the key is to get involved in something. And I also think you hit on a point there that's very important, which is that most baby boomers are not prepared financially for retirement in the way that most people think you're supposed to be, like maybe our parents were, where you had an amount that you had to have, and you had a pension, and when you reached that golden age of 65, you took your check and your watch and whatever, and you went off and did things.
But you
didn't have, you didn't have 20 or 30 years after that to have to worry about. Well, we do.
No, and you had, and you often, you know, with all the refinancing frenzy, a lot of people, including myself, haven't paid off their mortgages or still have house debt that you didn't really expect to have. But, you know, I wanted to say one thing about that I found from interviewing a lot of people, that I think the two things that I found after retirement and from talking to people that were really important, you know, one is that if there is something that you wanted to do, whether it's as simple as going to the gym twice a week, that you really need to put that in the calendar, because it's very easy when you retire. There's really not a void. You know, there could be between, you know, people who have new grandchildren, for instance, you know, or or a neighbor who is sick, that things get filled up. So it's important to have a couple of things that you do for yourself that you really want it to do, or else you start to feel resentful. And then the other thing is to have human contact. You know, by far, a lot of the studies that I read just said that there's, there's a study out of Harvard where somebody followed thousands and thousands of people, and by far social engagement was the key to happiness. And even if you're shy, and it's not to say you have to go to parties all the time or join a million things, but you know, meeting somebody for coffee or for dinner or finding a volunteer opportunity that really works out for you, which could take a while, but a place where you really feel comfortable and you enjoy it. All those things are key to all of our happiness, really.
Yeah, and I think that that is a very key piece of the anxiety we talked about, that so many people, as you just mentioned before, their work family is so much a part of their lives that when you arbitrarily pick a date and cut that off, there is really a sense of loss and grief, and we never talk about that. You know,
exactly.
But it's hard to make new friends and do new things when you've been in that environment for so many years and learn to trust those people. And they, as you said, you spend more time at work than you do at home. And so you remove that entire piece of your life. It is a huge void. So tell me, what's the key here? Is there some magic for how you move from anxiety to zen in retirement other than the fact that you need to be social?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that you just hit on was, you know, you've known these people for a long time. And when you go into a new situation, especially when you're older, you know, let's say you're in your mid, late 60s, is that it is a little like going into a new middle school. And I remember when I first walked into the Grotto, I just thought, these aren't my people. You know, where are my people? And the Grotto is in this kind of area of San Francisco that's really high-tech community. So I went out, walked around by myself for lunch, and everybody's plugged into their cell phones. And, you know, I just felt very out of it, you know, this older person. But it's important to be patient with yourself, because now I feel totally embraced by the Grotto community. Maybe I'm older than a lot of people, but in some ways that's good to be around a lot of younger people. So I think it's being patient with yourself. And I try and do things. I have a 20-minute hypnosis tape that a woman made for me many, many years ago when I was going through kind of a struggle when I was writing my memoir, Burned. And I play that three or four times a week. I take a yoga class every Saturday. I haven't been great about making it to the gym, but I try and do that. So there's a lot of self-care when you're going through this big transition that's more important than often at other times where you feel everything's stable and everything's the same. So I would recommend, you know, meditation tapes or a class like the Jon Kabat-Zinn class on mindfulness meditation and taking walks with friends, you know, and that would be the social component. So, and then there's one calming technique, which is so easy. It's every time you transition, like every time you go from your house to your car, your house to the subway, you take a deep breath into the count of four and then let it out to the count of eight. And, you know, I have mild asthma and I'm amazed at how shallowly I breathe during the day. And I think that's true for a lot of people. And
I think it's true for all of us.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Breathing is kind of important.
It is. It is indeed.
So that's a pretty easy one. But, you know, the other thing about volunteering, because there's a lot that's been going on. There's an organization called Encore.org that I've been involved in, and they've been doing a lot of intergenerational work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to realize that as an older person with a lot of experience, you have a lot to offer to other people,
yeah.
whether it's the local library, tutoring, and again, all of those connections and having something to do during the week. And some people don't want that, you know, at least for a while. You know, you mm-hmm. just don't want to have to get up and do anything.
Yes. Yeah, but, you know, I remember seeing yeah. that commercial on television. I think Prudential had the commercial of the woman who was working and decided that this particular day was her first day in retirement. And she literally took the alarm clock and threw it across the room and said, I don't have to pay attention to you anymore.
Oh, that's
very freeing. I know. It's very freeing.
Totally freeing. Yeah. And,
Let's talk about another book that you wrote two of them actually, that I'm really curious about what was behind these. And you talked about Burned, a Memoir. So what prompted Burned, a Memoir?
Okay, well, when I was 4 years old, I grew up in New York City. And when I was 4 years old, my dad, you know, had enough. He was a doctor in New York, and he felt like he was doing well enough that we could all go on a 3-week vacation in Cape Cod. So it was very exciting. And mm-hmm. And by the way, I should mention from, you know, your introduction to the podcast that my mother was somebody who was quite amazing as a woman for her time. She was ended up being an editor for the American Journal of Nursing and really believed that women should have their own money
wow.
and own checking account. And I mean, some of that was because her own father had left the family when she was 9, and she mm-hmm. saw the importance of really taking care of yourself. So my parents were both had you know, professional jobs, careers that they loved. So it wasn't only my dad. But we went to Cape Cod, and it's a long story. So, you know, but they went down to light a pilot light in the basement, and the basement exploded. And my parents were severely burned, especially my mother. She was facially disfigured for the rest of her life, and very,
wow.
you know, her hands were terribly burned. And they made it out of the cellar. And then my sister and I were upstairs and, you know, we're fortunately not burned, but we didn't see our parents for 9 months.
Oh,
and we
my
lived
goodness.
With my uncle and aunt on a farm. And so the book started, I started out as a poet and I was writing so many poems about this. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to try my hand at a book, which was really tough and challenging, but I love to write. And so it, you know, it ended up with, you know, between teaching and the kids and actually this other book on rituals that I wrote, it took me probably about 15 years to rewrite, get an agent, finally sell it. You know, that's a whole other story, but it's really,
yeah,
I know.
You didn't have self-publishing at the time, right?
No, exactly.
And,
you know, on the other hand, it's, you know, in terms of tying it into my retirement book, which I have a little about it in the retirement book, you know, life can change at any moment. And I think I learned that in a sad way when I was 4 years old, you know, that suddenly my parents were gone. But it also made me realize when I, you know, got into my early 60s and I felt so oppressed by my job that, you know, it's important to live the life that you want to lead, you know, and do the best you can. So, yeah, so that book was just actually republished. And, you know, I do memoir workshops and I work with helping people develop their memoirs. So, you know, it's turned into a wonderful thing for me because, you know, through writing this book, I've developed this expertise, and I have another memoir with my agent right now, and I'm helping others, you know, to get their stories out into the world.
I love that. I think that's great work. There's so many people that have stories that you don't know anything about. When you meet them in your work environment, let's say, you know, you meet them where they are at the moment. But the stuff that went on in their lives before that, you have no clue. And I think that is an extremely valuable resource to have somebody help you to write your memoirs.
Yeah.
Let's go to another one that this is, I'm fascinated on this one. How to bury a goldfish, 113 rituals for everyday life. Now, what prompted that other than the obvious?
Well, it was interesting. I co-authored that book with my friend Virginia Lang, and some of it was inspired by, you know, my own feelings at that point, or even now, about where I was in terms of religion. My dad was Jewish, but we didn't really have any kind of Jewish rituals or, you know, synagogue or anything. He was more of a an atheist Jew. And my mom, her adoptive father was a Presbyterian minister, you know, who ended up taking us to church in New York.
Okay.
So I went to an Episcopal church when I was young. And then when it was time for my kids to have some kind of religious training, we ended up going to the Unitarian church. And I liked the fact that there were all these rituals, simple things like lighting a candle when you have dinner and thinking of people who need good energy sent to them, or thinking of people who don't have as much as you do. So we wanted to cull different types of rituals for different stages of life into a book. And there aren't that many things. For instance, for teenagers, there's basically, you know, the driver's license. So, so we put, you know, other things in for, you know, a young woman, for a young man, and a lot of things for little kids. Some, you know, fun things like doing a performance and, you know, how parents can celebrate a child that way, and some sad things like, you know, a death of a parent, and how you could have a little shelf or an altar that a child has access to. So it's not as if, oh, the parent's just gone. You know, how do you emotionally connect with a child and allow them to have their feeling? So yeah, it's a mixture of all kinds of fun things and different stages of life. So it was fun to write, and we actually got it.
I bet it was. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was actually republished. It started at Rodale and then republished by Unitarian Press. So, it was fun. Did a lot of radio spots on, you know, different rituals. So it was good, you know.
Let's switch this over now. I'd like to talk to you about a couple of things about your relationship with money, how you learned about money when you were younger, and how that influenced your life. So let me ask some of these questions you've actually already answered in the course of this conversation. But what lessons specifically about money did you learn when you were growing up?
You know, it's interesting. I think there were two threads going on. You know, one had to do with the fact that my parents grew up during the Depression. And I mentioned before that, you know, my mother's real father, he actually emptied the bank account and left the family destitute. And so she learned that, you know, she really, as a woman, you know, and her mother remarried. So, you know, it all worked out. But that, I mean, not that marriage, you know, is necessarily always the key, but but I don't want to make sense. Oh, she remarried and it was all great. But she remarried a really nice man who's a minister, and, you know, they had a not a very moneyed life, but they had a good life. And so I think I learned that it's important to, as a woman, to have your own money, or, you know, and not to, on the one hand, not to be frivolous. You know, I mean, my mother was quite frugal, and at times I didn't really like her way of dealing with money. You know, there was a lot of anxiety around it, which I think I picked up. You know, even though my dad was a doctor, he wasn't one of the, you know, we didn't have a country house and tons of money, you know, he was a, but we had more than enough money, and I had all the opportunities that any kid could have, you know, summer camps, and I went to this, you know, private progressive school and all of that. So it was a, it was the other, you know, that one thread was frugal, and the other one was do things that you love to do. So, you know, for instance, we would, my mother would take me shopping, and we would go to some budget store, and then we would stand outside in Manhattan, where I grew up, waiting for the bus. And, you know, we would always ride public transportation. I kind of grew up on that. But every once in a while, she would say, oh, let's just get in a cab. You know, so there would be that part of her, and she loved to travel. She actually went on the QE2 twice, once when she was 75 and once when she was 80, because she had the money and she wanted to. She went in a wheelchair the second time. So I had that, and, you know, I haven't had as much money as my parents had. You know, part of it is, you know, maybe I wasn't as good with it. Part of it is things are more expensive. So I have to stop myself at times. I mean, I kind of joke that she's actually sitting right next to me. I have a designer dog. I paid a lot of money for a purebred dog because I have a lot of allergies. And, you know, was that really in my budget? Not really. But, you know, she gives me so much pleasure. You know, that's unfortunately great. She's quiet during this interview, but so I have to rein myself in at times. You know, I feel like some of the things that I did, you know, refinancing, you know, we got scholarships for the kid. I mean, they got scholarships, but they did go to a private high school, and they ended up going to a private college, and I probably overspent. They could have gone to a, you know, University of California school or this or that. I don't regret it, but I also see my tendency, you know, so I think it's two things, you know, but I like to adventure too. So my husband and I might drive cross country this summer.
Nice.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, so, what do you think has been the most threatening to your financial security?
Well, I think the decision that we made in the past of refinancing our mortgage was a decision that in the end has made it much tougher in our retirement. We have 7 years now to finish paying off our mortgage, but, you know, I'm 69 and my husband's 75. I mean, better late than never, but it's created a certain amount of stress, and we've done, you know, I have to teach workshops, and we do actually Airbnb our whole house, which is one reason we're going to, we've been doing that for about 4 years, but we have to move, you know, to a friend's house or downstairs, and we're getting a little old to be vagabonds. So that's our big decision.
I like that.
Yeah. So our big decision this summer to, you know, take our dog in the car and have somebody manage the Airbnb is a new step for us, because we have a lot of family and old friends back east. So so the biggest threatening thing, I think, has been having a mortgage, you know. And I'm
having
very
a mortgage,
lucky.
Having a mortgage in retirement is
yes,
what it is.
Having
is
a
right?
mortgage
okay.
in retirement. Yes, having a mortgage in retirement. And the fact that my husband worked for many, many years as a contract worker, so he only has Social Security, and he never got a pension. And I do have a pension, and I did buy some years back. I did a lot of things to try and help me get as many years as possible. So we could live in a lot of other places and be fine, you know, or rent out our house. We do have, we have options that a lot of people don't have. So I'm very grateful for that. But day to day, it's somewhat of a struggle. You know, had I stayed longer in my job, or, you know, had Jim stayed longer and gotten more of a Social Security. But in the end, it was our our mental and physical health that we chose. And again, I don't really regret that at all. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. And that was the last question I was going to ask. Would you do anything differently? Any regrets?
Well, you know, in the end, I'm thinking, you know, I said to my daughter at one point, you know, because she was saying it was a little hard to be in a private school. She didn't have as much money, you know, and she did get into a good public school. Would you have rather done that? And she said, no, I felt like I got such a great education, Mom, and I'm really happy. And I thought, okay, I can't really regret, you know, spending the money for their education. In the end, no. I mean, maybe not refinancing my house, but, maybe in the end, no. It's probably, you know, and then I feel kind of silly to have regrets because you can't do anything about them.
I was just going to say that. I think that's a waste of effort. And you know, people just go back and think about, oh, I should have done this. Well, you didn't. Nothing. So
I just find
it interesting to see what people say when I ask that question. But anyway, thanks to my guest, Louise Nayer. And Louise, tell people how they can get in touch with you if they would like to talk to you about writing their memoirs or any other questions.
Okay, well, my email is Louise, L-O-U-I-S-E, Nayer, N as in Nancy, A-Y-E-R, louisenayer@gmail.com. And I also have a website, which is just louisenayer.com. And so there are also ways to get in touch with me through the website. But either way, love to hear from people.
Okay. Well, to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, I hope today's podcast was helpful in enriching your understanding of important financial matters and how some knowledge of money can go a long way to easing the burdens of life. Thanks again, Louise, for sharing your time and knowledge. And until the next time, thanks for listening, everybody. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye.
Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.